building green, high-technology vehicles here, but we can become a world leader and once again be producing vehicles that people around the world want to buy. And I think that we have great reason to be hopeful in that way. The U.S. has really led in technology in the past, and we can do that in the future, but we have to make a real commitment, and we have to be self-conscious to doing it.
Damon, one of my colleagues here at WPCAN, Melinda Tuhus, recorded a talk recently by journalist, author, and climate activist Bill McKibben, who is organizing along with other groups around the country and around the world something called 350.org, and it's a campaign that will be launched on October 24th in action in advance of the Copenhagen climate change treaty negotiations to really focus the world's attention on that number, 350, which is the parts per million of carbon, which we have to, I guess, come down to that level in order to support life on the planet. But tell our listeners a little bit about that campaign and others which they could plug into to really focus, again, the average person's attention on these issues that, as you said before, to many sound too complex to comprehend.
Right. Well, I think, you know, the reality of the situation is that the international community is going to come together at this absolutely historic landmark treaty conference in early December, and that what has always seemed like a long way away, many years away of negotiations, is really now just around the corner. And this initiative, like so many others, are really going to be trying to get people to realize that we need to pay attention right now, that this is a very historic moment. And unfortunately, our government appears to be moving in a direction of not leading at that conference, but potentially spoiling at that conference. That once again, if we don't get these targets right, if we don't get these policies right, the U.S. at this treaty conference is going to be perceived as a significant part of the problem and not part of the solution. So, this campaign is an important one, as are many others that are going to be trying to get the U.S. public to pay attention to the fact that we've got to do the right thing at this conference and that we've got to be telling President Obama and Secretary of State Clinton that they have got to show real leadership and decisive leadership in negotiating for this treaty.
Well, Damon Mugglin, I want to thank you so much for being here tonight, and leave our listeners, if you would, with a website for Greenpeace as well as any phone numbers for people who don't have easy access to the
web. People should certainly come to Greenpeace's website, which is www.greenpeace.org, and we've got a whole big section on climate change and global warming issues, and we've certainly got links to other organizations that people should be taking a look at. So thank you so much for letting me appear on the program, Scott.
Okay. Dan, is there a phone number people who don't have easy access to the Internet can get?
Oh, by all means, people are welcome to call Greenpeace here in Washington at 202-462-1177.
Okay, that's 202-462-1177.
That's right.
And greenpeace.org.
That's right.
Thanks again, Damon.
Thank you so much.
Best of luck. Bye-bye. Damon Mugglin, Greenpeace Global Warming Campaign Director here on WPKN in Bridgeport, WPKM in Montauk, the program Counterpoint. So we invite you to stay tuned next. We're going to be talking about the crisis in the North Korean Peninsula, and we hope you'll stay tuned for that and lots more coming up this evening. Go to our website, WPKN.org, and you can listen online if you're out of our broadcast area. Get to know our program schedule if you're new to the station. You can make a secure online contribution to help us stay afloat in these tough economic times. They are for you as well as for us. Maybe find out how to volunteer. We got a fundraising week coming up starting Saturday, special programs. I'll make an announcement here a little bit more about the details in a few minutes. But, go to our website, WPKN.org, to get to know us a little bit more in case you're new to this station. Stay tuned. We'll be back in just a couple of moments. I made a mistake. This is WPKN in Bridgeport, WPKM in Montauk. My name is Scott Harris. The program is Counterpoint. And right now, we're very happy to introduce to you John Pfeffer, co-director of Foreign Policy and Focused. He also works with the Institute for Policy Studies based in Washington, D.C., and a former Pan Tech Fellow in Korean Studies at Stanford University. John, thanks so much for being here tonight.
Thanks for having me on your show.
So we have another crisis on the Korean Peninsula, and as these things go, you know, it seems it's quite disconcerting that there really is no solution in sight in terms of calming these tensions down. Our listeners are certainly aware, if they've been watching the news over the last week or two, that after North Korea's underground nuclear bomb test and the firing of some short-range missiles, tensions have risen both between the U.S. and North Korea and between Seoul and Pyongyang. The North renounced the truce between North and South Korea in place since the Korean War ended in 1953. And from what I've been reading, and I know you and our listeners have too, military alert levels rose to the second highest level there is. So a lot of disturbing stuff going on out there. And I'd like to begin by asking you this, John. North Korea is generally branded in the West by our government and our media as a rogue state run by Kim Jong-il, certainly more often than not characterized as psychotic, insane, crazy, whatever terminology you want to use, and that these latest moves by North Korea are interpreted as a symptom of an internal succession struggle. Maybe you could sort of just handle that at the outset here as to why the nuclear detonation, why the missile tests, why the rattling of sabers here.
Mm-hmm. Well, people might remember that North Korea tested its nuclear device for the first time in 2006. And after that test, many people, many experts, declared the test a dud. And I think that the first priority for North Korea is to dispel any kind of doubts that it has a viable nuclear program. To be honest with you, though, we still don't know the capabilities that North Korea has. Don't know if it, you know, can actually miniaturize a nuclear weapon, deliver a nuclear weapon, etc. Nonetheless, I think this is priority number one for a country that is largely surrounded by adversaries and which is in a pretty lousy economic situation. And the second reason, I think, is that it wanted to get the attention of the Obama administration. North Korea is pretty much fixated on the United States and getting U.S. attention. It believes the United States holds the key to any kind of solution on the Korean Peninsula for it. And it wasn't getting a lot of attention from the Obama administration. And, you know, Obama comes into office, he has a lot of things to do. He's got a big domestic agenda, and of course his foreign policy plate is pretty full too, with a global economic crisis, climate change, Iraq, Afghanistan, Iran, etc. North Korea wasn't very high on the priority list. So I think that was the other kind of major message. And then just quickly, the third one would be China. China reacted very negatively to North Korea's first nuclear test and to North Korea's rocket launch in April. And I think North Korea wanted to say, hey, you know, we are not China's pawn. We do what we want to do and not what Beijing tells us to do.
But to the question, is the North Korean state, does it have some logic? As you describe the motivation for this, is it safe to say that Kim Jong-il is not crazy?
I would say he's not crazy. I would say he's in a very, shall we say, weak position, and that dictates the logic of his actions. He has seen that countries that don't have deterrent capabilities have been either invaded or destabilized in some other way, and that's a concern he has. I mean, there are not a lot of countries of his variety left in the world. And he is quite isolated in Northeast Asia. Obviously, South Korea has become one of the most prosperous countries in the world. Japan, very prosperous. China, also major economy, and has drifted quite far apart from North Korea. Russia no longer as close an ally as it used to be. So basically, Kim Jong-il has to make decisions based on weakness. And that has dictated, I think, the decision to go forward with the nuclear program. Remember, North and South Korea used to be relatively equal in terms of their military capabilities or economic status. In the mid-70s or so, they started to diverge. Today, North Korea spends about $500 million a year on its military budget. South Korea alone spends about 40 times that amount. So if you're in North Korea and you're looking across the border at a country that's outspending you every year by 40 times, and then you add in U.S. military and Japanese military, you have to ask yourself, well, what can we do to even the playing field? Well, logically speaking, that means going for a weapon of mass destruction.
John Pfeffer, there are many reports that Kim Jong-il suffered a stroke, a serious stroke, back in August, and that some of the recent moves by his military may be tied into a succession struggle where the military may be vying to replace him as leader. A lot of speculation all over the map. What do you think is happening there in North Korea?
Well, first, I would say it's very difficult to know what's going on inside Pyongyang. I mean, we're just learning right now a lot of the things that went on here in Washington during the Bush administration. We were living here, and we didn't know what was going on. So we have less intelligence about what's going on inside North Korea. However, it's quite clear that Kim Jong-il, who's about 67 or so years old, suffered a stroke and has had an impairment of health. The question really is what impact that has had on any decisions that are made in the foreign policy realm. And I'm not sure it has had that much impact. I think that Kim Jong-il has relied on the military ever since he became the leader of North Korea after his father's death in 1994. The military has been his primary institutional backer. And it's really the only kind of major functioning institution in the society, much more important than the party, for instance. So I don't think that, for instance, the military took over when Kim Jong-il suffered a stroke. I think the military had always had a great deal of influence. In terms of the succession itself, there is no clear successor. With Kim Il-sung, his father, Kim Il-sung had his son, Kim Jong-il, and had groomed him for a decade or more to become his successor. Kim Jong-il has three sons, and he hasn't really groomed any of them to become his successor. In part, it's because apparently he's not really satisfied with any of them, rather disappointed with his offspring, which leads to some speculation that maybe someone else will be a successor, perhaps a caretaker regime. He has a brother-in-law, for instance, that might do the job. But again, I don't know if this has a great deal to do with the nuclear crisis. It's all speculation. I think much more important really are the change in the South Korean government, which happened about a year ago. It became a much more conservative government in South Korea and much less interested in engagement with North Korea. And then disappointment with what had occurred in negotiations with the Bush administration during the last couple of years of the second term of George W. Bush. I think North Korea expected to get a lot more during those negotiations, and it didn't get all the heavy fuel oil that was promised, not because of the United States, but more because of South Korea and Japan not fulfilling their obligations. But North Korea expected more sanctions to be removed, expected there to be more steps taken toward diplomatic, political, economic engagement. Those weren't taken. So I think that has much more to do with these tests than any political turmoil inside Pyongyang.
We're speaking with John Pfeffer, co-director of Foreign Policy in Focus, also working with the Institute for Policy Studies. John, I wanted to ask you this. As you said, South Korean President Lee Myung-bak has moved to the right, a more conservative president than his predecessor, who just committed suicide, by the way, our listeners might have heard. But are the South Korean people on board with President Lee's more confrontational policies towards North Korea?
Well, that's a tough question. I mean, public opinion is pretty volatile in South Korea, and it switches rapidly from month to month. I think when Lee Myung-bak was running for government, there were a lot of concerns that the previous 10 years of engagement policy with North Korea, first under Kim Dae-jung and then under his successor, Noh Moo-hyun, who recently committed suicide because of unrelated corruption issues, there were feelings that South Korea had given a lot and not gotten much in return. I don't think that was a correct perception, but anyway, that was the perception among many people. And I think it contributed to Lee Myung-bak's victory. Subsequently, however, Lee Myung-bak's position on North Korea has led to a worsening in relations north-south. And quite a few people, judging from opinion polls, feel very negatively toward his handling of North Korean issue, feeling in part that it has contributed to the current crisis, and that many promising projects, for instance, the Kaesong Industrial Complex, which is a project that's located just north of the demilitarized zone in North Korea, a kind of big industrial park that is funded with South Korean capital and managed by South Korean companies, but hires North Korean workers to produce things like pots and pans and knives and watches for sale largely in South Korea. That projects like that are on the verge of collapse because of Lee Myung-bak's policies. So I think there is a lot of disenchantment, and that has contributed to Lee Myung-bak's significant dip in popularity in the polls.
What about UN sanctions? There's a lot of discussion since this recent nuclear test and the missile tests that the United Nations, the United States, the European Union, and even China to some extent are looking hard at sanctioning North Korea now as they maybe haven't in the past. Will that change North Korea's behavior at all? Will that bring about negotiations, do you think?
Well, the jury is out on that. Some people argue that sanctions in the past have led to a change in North Korean behavior. And the example they use, the sanctions that were applied to Banco Delta Asia, which is a Chinese bank, and North Korea held some money in that bank. And the Treasury Department basically cracked down on Banco Delta Asia, put a lot of pressure on it, and froze North Korean bank accounts there. It wasn't a lot of money, but apparently North Korea is very concerned that this was somehow the first signal, perhaps, that it would be cut off from the international banking system altogether, and that it is argued, produced some flexibility in its negotiating position. I'm not so sure about that. I know that North Korea was upset about the Banco Delta Asia issue, but I think it became more flexible in its position, in part because the Bush administration became more flexible in its position. We have to remember that the Banco Delta Asia sanctions came just around the same time as a major breakthrough in the six-party talks and the negotiating framework designed to denuclearize the peninsula. So today, what will the sanctions do? Well, there are a lot of sanctions already applied to North Korea, so there isn't a lot of room there for maneuver to add more. There is discussion of sanctioning the leadership, in other words, kind of preventing the leadership from getting its goodies from outside the country, whether it's fine whiskey or caviar or nice cars or what have you. That is notoriously difficult to do. I mean, they're able to get that kind of stuff from China without having to go directly to Germany or Switzerland or Tokyo or wherever they would buy these gourmet items. So I'm not sure whether sanctions would really have any kind of effect. So we'll see. I mean, I suspect that North Korea, in the situation it's in right now, in which it feels like it's up against the wall and it has few recourses for action, will not be really affected by additional sanctions.
John Pfeffer referred to the leadership and luxury goods and the like, and certainly North Korea is one of the most secretive societies in the world today. And there's a lot of reporting that does get out of North Korea that indicate to people in the United States and around the world that the people of North Korea live under a virtual slave state. And I wonder, from your studies of North Korea, what is the attitude and what is the level of suffering of the average North Korean citizen? And what, if anything, are they doing to change their situation internally, if they can at all exert any influence there?
Well, first of all, I'd say that North Korea is not really like Eastern Europe was in the 1970s and 1980s, or the Soviet Union during that period. In both Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union, you had small but active civil societies. They might be thrown in jail. Activists like Václav Havel in Czechoslovakia, of course, was thrown in jail. Andrei Sakharov, thrown in jail. But they existed, and they formed, you know, small but influential groups. There's nothing like that in North Korea. There's no civil society. There are no individuals like Andrei Sakharov, at least not yet. What you have instead is a society that, at the moment, is largely focused on survival. There was a significant food crisis, a famine, really, in the 1990s. It killed a large portion of the population. We still don't know how many. Could have been as many as 10%, although probably not quite that many. The food crisis is over, the acute one, but we still have a chronic food problem inside North Korea. There are today, as compared to back in the 90s, a pretty substantial set of markets throughout the country that supply the population with a large amount of its food supply, and also employ, at least informally, a large portion of the population. So a lot of people are just focused on getting by. They're not so much focused on changing the government or organizing some form of civil society. We're talking about 22, 23 million people or so. About 200,000, so that's an estimate, and you can see that that's, you know, about... obviously, less than 1%, considerably less than 1%, are in labor camps. And we don't have much information. We have some reports from defectors who were in those camps, and the conditions there are horrifying. But I think, you know, if you're talking about considerably less than 1% of the population, you know, we're talking about the majority not really paying much attention to what's going on there and focusing on their own lives, on getting by in their own lives. So I think that's the situation right now. It could change, obviously. But I would say that civil society generally flourishes at a time when there is less of a crackdown. And there's considerable crackdown at this point in North Korea. The leadership is paranoid, paranoid externally, paranoid internally, and that is not good news for anybody inside the country. So I would say that if we're interested in seeing the development of civil society, a more diverse politics, a more diverse economy inside North Korea, then we have to think about how to create those conditions, create conditions under which the government doesn't feel the need to crack down so heavily on the population. And I think we can only do that through a kind of engagement policy.
Yeah, I want to certainly touch on that before we say goodnight, John Pfeffer. But one other question before we get to that most important question. And that is, North Korea has declared that the United States and South Korean intention to board North Korean vessels or other vessels cruising to their ports to search for unconventional weapons would be an act of war, and that there would be dire consequences if these ships were boarded. Is this a potential flashpoint for conflict, do you think?
It definitely is. There are periodic naval clashes between North and South Korea, and they've occurred even at times of relative good relations. during Kim Dae-jung's term of office, for instance. South Korea actually sunk a North Korean ship. So at a time in which the relations between the two countries are not good, you can imagine that a naval clash could have even greater consequences. So these clashes take place in the disputed kind of ocean on the west coast of the peninsula, and there are some fishing grounds there that both sides dispute who controls. So, yes, you could definitely see a clash, which might start either as a result of argument over territory or an argument over South Korea attempting to board a North Korean ship under this Proliferation Security Initiative in an attempt to prevent weapons of mass destruction going in or out of North Korea. North Korea could retaliate, and the incident could escalate from there. We have to remember that, you know, I think most sides in the region, whether you're talking about the two Koreas or Japan or China or the United States, recognize the dire consequences of war in the region. And the Pentagon has done any number of studies of what the first month of military conflict on the Korean Peninsula would look like right now, and it would lead to several hundred thousand deaths. So no one really wants this to happen, but of course wars are rarely planned out in advance.
Well, John, now to that very important question. President Obama recently in Europe talked about the importance of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, and even mentioning North Korea as an example of where the world has a lot of work to do. Where do you think the Obama administration's policy is headed regarding North Korea? And if you were to advise the president on shaping his policy in maybe a different direction than past presidents, what would you tell him?
Well, I'm waiting for the phone call. But if I do get that phone call, I would say, you know, the current policy is not the right direction for the United States. I certainly understand that the Obama administration has a lot of other priorities and that North Korea is not a particularly high priority. Second, I understand why it's not a particularly good time to reach out a hand of friendship to North Korea after it's tested a nuclear weapon and engaged in rather hostile rhetoric. That could, of course, you know, be a real let off a firestorm of conservative criticism here in the United States of the Obama administration. So I understand the difficulties of approaching this issue. However, I think that right now we have a very small window of opportunity before North Korea has its nuclear program back up and running rather significantly. And I think that we need to send an envoy to Pyongyang sooner rather than later. That envoy could address a different issue at first rather than the nuclear issue. Could address the issue, for instance, of the two detained journalists, American journalists who are in North Korea after North Korea basically arrested them, accused them of violating North Korea's borders by coming in through China. An envoy could go over and talk about that issue, and that could break the ice. Could lead to perhaps more quiet discussions about the nuclear program. I don't think we really have much of a choice. The military option's off the table. I think neglecting North Korea has, in the past, simply led to North Korea developing a more robust nuclear program and engaging in provocative behavior. Only through engagement have we managed to basically put a cap on North Korea's nuclear program, freezing it in the 1990s during the agreed framework period, and then leading to a 70-80% dismantlement of the Yongbyon facility in the last couple of years of the Bush administration. I think those are the examples that are in front of us. Just a question of when we decide to go back to the table. I think we should do it sooner rather than later.
Well, John, thank you so much for contributing some important ideas and analysis to the discussion on the situation in the Korean Peninsula. And please let our listeners know where they can read some of your recent articles. I know Foreign Policy and Focus is one such place, but run down some of the websites, if you would.
Sure. People can go to Foreign Policy and Focus at www.fp, ipif.org. They want to find out more information about the Institute for Policy Studies. We're at www.ips-dc.org. And if they're exclusively interested in the articles I write, they can go to my website, which is www.johnpfeffer, J-O-H-N, F as in Frank, E, F again, E-R, .com, johnpfeffer.com.
All right. Well, thanks so much for making time for our discussion tonight on this really important issue, John. I hope we can have you back to talk more about this in the future.
Sounds good. I look forward to it.
All right. Well, take care, and thank you again.
Bye-bye.
John Pfeffer, co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus, also works with the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C., and a former Pan-Tech Fellow in Korean Studies at Stanford University. This is Counterpoint. My name is Scott Harris. You're on WPKN in Bridgeport at 89.5 FM and WPKM in Montauk, New York at 88.7 FM. And just a program note here before we go to a little musical break, and that is if you want to hear some of these interviews in edited form in our national program, Between the Lines Radio News Magazine, you can go to our website. That's btlonline.org. And there you can sign up for free weekly program summaries, podcasts, interview transcripts, and the like. That's btlonline.org. Unfortunately, Counterpoint had been archived for many years on the whiterosesociety.org website, and our friend Ben Birch, somehow we've lost our connection in recent months, and we've endeavored to try and get that back in shape, but may need to go to an alternative, which I've been talking about on the air for many weeks now, and we have not gotten there yet, I'm sorry to say, but when we do, I will certainly announce it, hopefully in the next, I'm hoping, you know, in the next month or so, we will have a resolution to that. You know, it's nice to know there are people listening all over the country to this program, many of them through the White Rose Society website. But if you're such a person, we haven't forgotten. We will be getting to a solution, I'm hopeful, in the not-too-distant future. Right now, let's take a musical break, and we'll be back with a discussion on propaganda at the New York Times. Stay tuned.
Fifty years ago today, we stood in the rubble. The sun rose each morning through the smoke. The planes flew above us looking for something left to bomb. Our factories, our schools, lie ravaged and broke. Now you wonder why there is this anger, as we remember all too clearly a time that we once knew, when every home, every dam, and so many, many people were flattened to the ground by the things you had to do, when Korea was just another name for bombs falling from the sky. And home was just another word for this place where people die. Fifty years ago today, you killed my mother. I've lived my whole life and never knew the love she might have given, the joy she might have felt to sit in the garden where her grandchildren grew. And now you wonder why we might feel attacked. You wonder at the stand our leaders take. But it was you, I remember, who gave us this lesson of the sound of a city when it breaks. When Korea was just another name for bombs falling from the sky. And home was just another word for this place where people die. Years ago today, you killed my father. He was shooting at your planes when he died. Just one of how many million dead soldiers fighting and falling side by side. Now you wonder at what you call an evil axis. You throw words that someday will explode. We remember the last time you said these things, when crater was another word for road, when Korea was just another name for bombs falling from the sky, and home was just another word for this place where people die. Years ago today, we stood in rubble.
This is WPKN in Bridgeport, WPKM in Montauk. My name is Scott Harris. The program is Counterpoint. And right now we'd like to welcome to the show Peter Hart. He's the Activism Director at Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, otherwise known as FAIR, and co-host of FAIR's weekly program called Counterspin, heard here on WPKN on Thursday afternoons. Peter, thanks so much for being here with us tonight.
My pleasure.
FAIR always has some excellent analysis of what we're getting in the news, the spin it takes, as well as the omissions and distortions and the like. And one recent piece of analysis and an action alert, as you call it, that caught my ear and my eye was something written about a New York Times story published on May 21st, which a front page story, which made the case that former terrorist suspects imprisoned at Guantanamo Bay Naval Detention Center have returned to terrorist activity by a ratio of 1 in 7. And that story, of course, added a lot of fuel to the controversy about President Obama's plan to close Guantanamo and move some of the detainees to U.S. high-security prisons and release others who could not be charged with a crime. Peter, tell us a little bit about what were the facts as they were presented by the New York Times in this front-page story.
The New York Times story was very similar to reporting that's been done on earlier Pentagon reports of this nature. I think this is maybe the fifth or sixth time the Pentagon has come out with new numbers to try to prove that Guantanamo detainees pose a unique threat to the war on terror. So this particular piece came, front page piece, on, as you said, May 21st, 1 in 7 freed detainees rejoins fight, report finds. It was written by Elizabeth Buhlmiller, who was the Times correspondent covering George W. Bush for part of his presidency and now is the Pentagon correspondent. And the Pentagon leaked this, or someone at the Pentagon leaked this report to the Times in order to get that front page billing. Right around the same time, Obama and Cheney were giving what the media were calling dueling speeches on terror policy. And that 1 in 7 number became the talk of cable news that day and for the next couple of days. It's intended to tell us that Guantanamo detainees are unusually radicalized, unusually dangerous, and if let go, as you say, they would pose this threat to either U.S. interests at home or abroad. So that was the point that the Pentagon was trying to make, and I think the New York Times, by really sort of mishandling this story, they gave the Pentagon exactly the kind of rollout for this that they wanted, so that the backdrop to that Obama speech was Guantanamo is still filled with dangerous places, and no matter what he says about closing it, it's going to be difficult and potentially dangerous to Americans.
In terms of the journalism there at the New York Times, what kinds of fact checks were done here to this leak, which, as you said, came initially from the Pentagon itself?
Yeah, it looks like, you know, because the Pentagon released this report a couple days afterwards, so the jump that the Times got on the news was minimal. This was really done for the Pentagon's benefit. It wasn't because the Times got a unique perspective on this. And what I think what you would fail the Times for is the lesson is sort of in the lead. The two claims that are made right in the headline, 1 in 7 freed detainees rejoins fight. So you have two facts laid out, this 1 in 7 number and rejoining the fight. And two of these things are very problematic. When you broke down the numbers that were available from the Pentagon, this 1 in 7 number looks to be wildly exaggerated. It's hard to tell exactly how exaggerated because they don't name most of the detainees that they're talking about. Most of them cannot be named because they're apparently too dangerous. The second problem with the story is that when you're saying somebody rejoined the fight at Guantanamo or in the war on terror, you're saying that they were terrorists to begin with. And the interesting thing about this is that the author of the piece, Elizabeth Buemiller, went on television the day the Times printed it and sort of walked it back, saying, you know, rejoins might not be the right language to use in a piece like this because we don't know if these people were terrorists in the first place, which is why the Times went on to change the headline on their website and change some of the language in the actual report. As we pointed out, the Times seemed to acknowledge in the very beginning of the article that this was going to have political impact, and then by the way they reported it, they were sure to give it exactly the political impact that people on the right and at the Pentagon wanted it to have.
Would I get from this leak, the underside of the story, that there are people at the Pentagon who are trying to undermine Obama's policy of closing Guantanamo? Is that something that is certainly hidden here someplace?
You have to suspect that that's what's going on. At least that's part of it. And they knew, you know, we are not so naive to not understand the political dynamic here, that getting something on the front page of the New York Times in that right corner means that it's going to have unusual impact in the rest of the media, which is exactly what this story had, which is exactly the tactic from the run-up to the Iraq War, for example. You leak something to the New York Times, and then you have people who can go out and say, look, the New York Times is reporting today that X, Y, and Z. So I think it's a good guess that there were people inside the Pentagon who wanted these numbers out. The Times report and some of the other reports suggested that there were people who had mixed feelings about or mixed rationales for this, that there were some people who thought sitting on the numbers looked bad, and then there were other people who thought getting the numbers out is going to make this look good. Interestingly, a couple days after this was, almost a week, actually a little more than a week after this story ran, there was an op-ed co-authored by Peter Bergen, who's a terrorism expert and journalist, and the point of the op-ed in the New York Times was to say that most of the terror threats that are listed in this Pentagon report are vague, and a good number of them don't have anything to do with the United States. As he pointed out, something like 11 men named in this report are Saudis who are on a most wanted list put out by the Saudi kingdom. 9 of them are on that most wanted list because they're anti-royalists in Saudi Arabia. So these are not necessarily people who pose a threat to the United States or who are engaged in any activity that you could consider against U.S. Policy or targeting U.S. military personnel. So it's a really vague Pentagon report. They've all been vague, and this one is no different. The curious thing is to look at the New York Times and where they put this and the effect that it had. And, you know, when you look at all that and you add it all up, you suspect, as you say, that there are people at the Pentagon who really wanted this out.
What can we discern from the fact-checking that has been done, as you said, by Peter Bergen and others? Is it true that many of these detainees who are claimed to have gone back to terrorist or militant activity, in the story they were declared to have been, you know, terrorists to begin with, but as we know from the numbers of men who have been released from Guantanamo, there are certainly hundreds of them who have been released by the Bush administration because after years spending time in prison, they couldn't be charged with anything. So here we have a set of people who have been released that you really can't determine were terrorists to begin with.
Yeah, there's two things that you can think about this. The first being that if someone weren't a terrorist but were locked up in semi-solitary confinement without charges for a number of years, would that person become a terrorist? Would you produce one? And some of the evidence suggests that at least some of these people indeed were radicalized by that experience. And the McClatchy newspaper chain, the Wire Service, has done some reporting on some of the individuals who were put there under false pretenses, without charge, were released, and became radicalized by that experience, which is certainly not a stretch to imagine that kind of thing happening. You do look at the numbers, and Peter Bergen's done this and other people, and you can find, if you use a strict definition, you look at maybe a dozen detainees that they actually have solid confirmation. This is a dozen out of 534 who they've released. So it's nowhere near one in seven. And this is, again, even, I think, being charitable with how you determine who's a terrorist and whether or not you can even determine if they were terrorists in the first place. One of the best sources on this whole controversy is a guy named Mark Denbaugh, who teaches in a law school at Seton Hall, and he's done a number of reports on these Pentagon releases, and he looked at the status review tribunals, which the Pentagon has done to review the status of the detainees, and he could only find 4% of these proceedings ever allege that a detainee had ever been on any battlefield at all. So this is a prison camp that was mostly there to house people who couldn't be charged with anything. We could have a big debate about that, or we could talk about this tiny fraction of a percentage of former detainees who we think might be engaged in some form of quote-unquote terrorism. It's really looking at the entire Guantanamo problem and crime upside down to try to find a crime where, in most of the cases, there wasn't a crime to begin with.
Our guest tonight here on Counterpoint is Peter Hart, the Activism Director at the group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, and also co-host of Counterspin, the weekly program that's produced by FAIR. Peter, tell our listeners a little bit about the long-running relationship between the New York Times and the Pentagon, and go back, if you would, to Judith Miller, who in the run-up to the Iraq War, the 2003 U.S. invasion of Iraq, the New York Times played a very critical piece. The New York Times were extremely influential in terms of bolstering the Bush administration's disingenuous or flawed argument for going to war with Iraq.
Yeah, Judith Miller might be the most extreme example. There are others, but Miller, going back to the run-up to the war, was a very reliable ally of the Pentagon and of people around the White House who may or may not have worked directly at the Pentagon, but more worked in perhaps in Dick Cheney's office, other places like that. They were able to, I think in many ways, direct Judith Miller toward stories that would inflate the terrorism threat posed by Iraq, conflate these issues of Iraq and al-Qaeda, invent an Iraqi nuclear capability. This is the aluminum tubes reporting that happened late 2002 in the run-up to the Iraq War. Once the war got underway, Miller received a curious embedded assignment with one of the WMD teams. Her behavior on that assignment was, by many accounts, somewhat unusual. She seemed to be rather passionate about the need to find these WMDs. You almost got the sense that it was because they needed to vindicate her reporting more than anything else. And this is essentially what I think drove Miller away from that paper altogether. Curiously, one of her co-authors in some of those pieces was Michael Gordon, who continues to write for the paper and co-wrote the aluminum tube story, and he became a very reliable source for the Pentagon on two subsequent stories. The Iran meddling story, the idea that Iran was involved in the Iraq War and shipping roadside bombs and other kinds of weapons, and the idea that withdrawal from Iraq couldn't or shouldn't or wouldn't work. Gordon was instrumental in getting all of those issues into the New York Times exactly the way the Pentagon wanted them. So the Times, I think, has a long history here, and it's, I think, something you should always look out for. And the fact that Buemiller, who's, I think, could be considered one of their more compliant reporters, is now on the Pentagon beat is not good news for anyone that doesn't work at the Pentagon.
Peter, tell our listeners a bit about how FAIR's action alerts work and how they could subscribe to get these action alerts, and what, if anything, has happened as a consequence of launching this public alert about the New York Times acting as a propaganda shill for the Pentagon.
We can go to our website, FAIR.org, and sign up for the alerts and media advisories and that kind of news analysis that we put out. In this case, what we're asking for is the Times is one of the few papers that has an ombudsman. They call him a public editor. And it's his job to look at complaints from readers and members of the public who are concerned about how the Times has reported this or that story. And what we're asking him to do is take a look at what Buehmiller said after her story ran, namely, we're not sure these people can be considered rejoining a fight. They may not have been in a terrorism fight to begin with. Look at that and look at how the Times changed the headline. The headline went from 1 in 7 freed detainees rejoins the fight to later terror link cited, which is entirely different. They changed a little bit of the language in the piece as well. They've faced some criticism for this, and so far the Times has been saying the changes don't amount to anything, but we think they do, and we think that it's important that the Times acknowledge this in some way. If you got the hard copy of the New York Times, I know that's very old-fashioned, but if you got it that day, your copy of the paper never changed. The rhetoric on cable news all day was never affected by those tweaks that the New York Times made. So this is really an attempt to try to get the New York Times to be accountable for what they did and try to explain themselves. The fact that they ran an op-ed 8 days later called Inflating the Guantanamo Threat that really took issue with what the Times put on its front page is a suggestion that someone at the paper or a couple of someones are aware that they botched this story. And the public editor is one way, and in some ways the only way the public has to try to air this stuff. The public editor gets a column in the Sunday edition every other week. So I think there's a chance that he will take this up as an issue that is worth examining. And our thinking on is the more people who call him and write him, the more likely it is to put that pressure on him. They'll get the message loud and clear that people are concerned about this.
Peter, as I think it was Samuel Clemens, Mark Twain once said, a lie goes halfway around the world before the truth even gets its boots on. And what happens if there's some small section of the New York Times devoted to a five-sentence mea culpa? Does that really change anything?
I think we've always had a mixed verdict on this. You know, when people ask, you've been doing media criticism for 22 years, does it matter if you get these little things in the media? And I think in the short run, no. The tucked away correction doesn't matter. What matters is that you build people's awareness of these issues. You build an understanding among the public, among readers and skeptics and critics. And you teach people how to look at these things critically so that next time around, maybe, there will be this understanding in the public mind. It's a broad term, but people will feel like, we've been down this road before, and I remember when they tried to pull this one once, and it's not going to work this time on some of us. So you hope that that's the effect, and you also hope that reporters see this and say, that's a good point they made. Doesn't mean the reporter's necessarily going to write a column about how you really nailed the New York Times. But maybe next time down the road they'll be more critical or more skeptical or what have you. And that's, I think, the kind of little victory you want to have. The big victory, of course, is getting people thinking about this stuff and activated and reminding them that just because it's in the newspaper doesn't mean it's true.
Exactly right. And it's as you said, it's certainly a cumulative effect. And, the war is certainly a longer struggle than just this or that news cycle. But Peter Hart, before you go, I just wanted to ask you about some other interesting analyses that your group FAIR has done with regard to many of the claims of former Vice President Dick Cheney about how well torture worked to save the country from imminent terrorist attacks, as well as a bit about the controversy regarding House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and her claims that the CIA had lied to Congress in the past and had, as she said, in the case of her supposedly being briefed on these various torture policies invoked by the Bush administration. You want to just sort of give us an overview of torture and how well the media or how poorly it's performed here in covering this important issue?
Well, those two stories, I think, have one curious thing in common, and the fact that we're talking about a person, Dick Cheney, or an institution, the Central Intelligence Agency, that have a long history of misleading the American public, the public itself, or Congress, more narrowly. So, as a journalist, I think you approach these stories and wonder why anyone would take the CIA or Dick Cheney at face value. In the case of Cheney, it's hard to imagine why you'd want to listen to what he has to say about this stuff at all. We got a letter, I think, yesterday, somebody wondering why, what are the names of the people who keep putting Dick Cheney on television? And, you know, it's everyone. For whatever reason, there's this unusual appetite for listening to Dick Cheney in the corporate media. And I think both of these stories confront a very straightforward problem. There are claims that are made by Cheney that simply don't hold up to any kind of scrutiny. You can either question those claims and fact-check him as if it were, you know, campaign season and he were running for office, or you give him a microphone and tell him to say his piece and do pieces that contrast him with Barack Obama and treat this seriously. Most newspapers opted for the latter instead of the former. And McClatchy, again, not to talk too much about them, but they did a fact check of Cheney's claims and pointed out that the speeches that he's been making, the interviews he's done, are shot full of all sorts of errors and exaggerations, large and small. And I think it's an interesting moment for the media. You can treat this person seriously, or you can treat him as somebody who has been thoroughly discredited. And the latter characterization makes more sense, but it's more often than not the one that the media use. Nancy Pelosi, on the other hand, for whatever reason, and you can speculate all you want about this, is considered to be somebody who has a problem because she can't get her story straight. Her story has been rather straight all along. Whether you think it's honorable or not is another matter, but she has said that she didn't get a full briefing from the CIA about the kinds of methods that they were using on people they were detaining. Now, the CIA has no ability to debunk her. They've shown no proof that Pelosi's lying. But the guiding assumption of most of the coverage, if not all of the coverage, is that Pelosi isn't telling the truth and the CIA is. One of the examples is because the CIA has this very brief list of people they talk to and some of the subjects that were talked about. Most of them are very vague. There are no details. But the media took that as a sign that the CIA has got a story and Nancy Pelosi's got nothing. It doesn't make any sense if you look at it any kind of rational way, but it is the worldview of much of the media that these people at the CIA should be trusted more than Nancy Pelosi. A skeptic would say trust neither of them, but evaluate the claims that both of them are making. And the media haven't done that. And this is all going on as the CIA's stories are falling apart. They claim to have briefed one other senator four times, and he said, no, you briefed me once, so they changed their list. David Obey's office said, You said that one of my staff members was briefed. He wasn't. He was led out of the room before the briefing started, and they said, okay, yes. So there's no track record to suggest that even on this narrow issue, the CIA knows the story or can get the story straight. But the press, for whatever reason, has sort of played ball with them, which goes to show you that, you know, I think the institutional biases of the media are much bigger than who's in the White House at any given time. These are things that are happening right now in an administration that people, I think, believe the media are too easy on. I think the real story is that the media are enamored by some of these big, powerful institutions, no matter who's sitting in the White House.
And it seems no matter how vile or obscene the policies that are being promoted by people like Dick Cheney in terms of waterboarding and torturing people, and even had John Yoo, one of these lawyers in the White House who wrote these torture policies, saying in a public forum that he wouldn't see any problem with crushing a terrorist suspect's son's testicles in order to get him to talk. I mean, these people are just beyond the pale, and it's amazing that they are given any credibility in this debate at all. I am shocked at how bad things have gotten in terms of the public debate, particularly around this torture issue.
I remember John Yoo now has, a monthly column in the Philadelphia Inquirer. So, you know, newspapers are plenty eager to listen to this stuff and to print his opinions. You know, maybe he will explain his, you know, his testicle crushing policy further in the paper. But you think, you know, the perspectives that go begging in a major newspaper, and he's got a slot to opine on the issues of the day. It's sort of staggering.
Yeah, I don't know what to say after that. It's just, it's a sad state. Well, you know what you could say, Peter, before we say goodnight to you? Are there glimmers of hope out there? I mean, with many newspapers around the country failing, is there any shot in the arm for journalism that you can tell us about on the internet, elsewhere, new projects beginning, getting rid of this institutional filter that so often gives us the wrong information and questionable perspectives?
I think, you know, there are a lot of startups, a lot of things that are just beginning, and there are a lot of things that have been around for a long time, whether it's an alternative weekly newspaper or community radio or what have you. Those institutions have seen us through thick and thin, and they're here now as the technology is sort of changing the whole dynamic and shifting the very debate about what journalism is going to look like in 5 years or 10 years or 20 years. I was reading a excerpt of a speech that Barbara Ehrenreich, the author and journalist, gave to journalism graduates at UC Berkeley, and they reprinted this recently in the San Francisco Chronicle. And her message was to those journalists, look, I've been in this business through various kinds of ups and downs. Right now is a particularly down point, but maybe the silver lining here is that we're going to get back to the idea of journalism as it was when I was getting into it. Namely, a working class profession with working class roots, people who looked skeptically at government officials, who demanded honesty and accountability. And she really made a call for a kind of guerrilla journalism that would get back to basics, back to its roots, not the journalism of punditry and sophistry. This would be a serious kind of redoubling of our commitment to what journalism is supposed to be about. And, you know, if that's what the future looks like, then it's exciting. And I think the fact that the industry or the big outlets are in chaos and economic turmoil of their own sort can be a good thing. It can sort things out and clarify in people's minds what newspapers and news outlets are supposed to be for. So if a lot of big media outlets overextended themselves and bought too many different properties and are now going to reap the consequences of making bad business decisions, well, you know, there could most certainly be a silver lining there. And the fact that the public has more options now, I think, is a good thing. So, as we let these thousands upon thousands of flowers bloom, we might see something, that, you know, the future might look very different. And that's something, I think, to cheer no matter what happens.
Well, thank you for that optimistic note to leave on, Peter Hart. Appreciate you being here tonight and all your hard work over at Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. So we'll look forward to talking with you again soon. And our listeners can tune in Thursday afternoons at 2:30 p.m. to hear Fair's weekly news magazine, which is called Counterspin. Peter, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
Peter Hart, activism director and co-host of Counterspin, over at Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, FAIR. Their website is fair.org, fair.org, and you can get a lot of these articles and analysis and sign up for their action alerts, as they call them, to alert you to some extreme bias and omission in our corporate media. We got some messages to bring you. We're going to be back with a 32-year veteran employee of General Motors. So do stay with us here on WPKN in Bridgeport, WPKM in Montauk.
Oh, baby, come on.
Welcome to Music of the 60s. The show is live with the emphasis on the sound of music, featuring new arrangements of some of the current songs and some of your old favorites. You know, not all of the music of today is like this. Some of it is like this.
We should know that the purpose of creation is expansion of happiness.
All flowers delight him. He finds it more to the point that a plant, after being green, should send up a stalk and at its top burst into color.
Take the bait, baby.
Summer of love.
Ever since I blew my mind, everything has just been so groovy. It's just been so groovy.
That is just beautiful.
Helping you to build a better neighborhood and more beautiful America. The
wife of the President of the United States.
This is Mrs. Lyndon Johnson.
Man, it's groovy. And dig yourself. Really groovy.
It seems to me that a good time is much easier had by all now than ever before.
Are you ready to go out of your mind?
I think we're a much stupider country today than we were then.
Just a moment, please. Just a moment. This is a free country, and I respect your right, your opinion.
Tune in Saturday, June 6th, for Summers of Love, music that moved us back in the 1960s, as we kick off another 8 days a week of fundraising.
And it's cool.
Here on listener-supported WPKN 89.5 in Bridgeport and WPKM 88.7 in Montauk. It'll be really groovy.
Senator Kennedy has been shot in the head.
Sirhan Sirhan is serving a life sentence for killing Senator Robert F. Kennedy on June 5, 1968. However, recent forensic evidence indicates that Sirhan did not fire the fatal bullets. Please join me, Ken McDermott Rowe, for Who Killed Bobby on History Counts on Thursday, June 4th at 12:30 p.m. and Sunday, June 7th at 10 p.m. That's Who Killed Bobby on History Counts on Thursday, June 4th at 12:30 p.m. and Sunday, June 7th at 10 p.m. right here on listener-supported WPKN.
Going back to the 60s, 40 years ago, and our fun drive kicks off this coming Saturday for 8 days, and we hope you'll tune in, support this listener-supported station, and tune in also for some great programming. Again, kickoff June 6th, Saturday. And right now, Aaron Counterpoint, I want to welcome to the program Frank Hammer. He's a 32-year veteran employee of General Motors, now retired. He also served as the past president of United Auto Workers Local 909 in Warren, Michigan. And on this day when General Motors filed bankruptcy, it seems appropriate to have someone who spent a good deal of his life working at General Motors. And want to welcome you to the program tonight. Frank, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you for the invitation.
So I'm sure many of our listeners are aware of a lot of the details around the bankruptcy of General Motors, but I'm just going to read a couple of paragraphs summarizing what's happened today, and then I'd certainly like to get your comments and gut feelings about what this day means to you. But here in summary is General Motors followed Chrysler into bankruptcy today in a case that will be one of the largest and most complex in history. It hopes to follow the same path Chrysler has taken through court, but there will be some differences between the two cases. And GM is reorganizing under Chapter 11 of the United States Bankruptcy Code. The law allows companies to sell assets, restructure debt, cancel contracts, and close operations that normally would have to continue running. Once the companies secure financing to emerge from bankruptcy, they are reconstituted as new legal entities. Should General Motors fail to successfully reorganize, it might turn to Chapter 7 bankruptcy, which would mean liquidation. But that is not seen as a likely outcome given support from the Treasury Department and the Obama administration generally. There has been a lot of shares of stock offered to bondholders as well as the United Auto Workers in exchange for concessions. And I know we'll be talking about some of that tonight, Frank. But as you look on more than three decades that you spent working at General Motors, what are some of your feelings today?
The unthinkable is what's happening, and certainly it makes me wonder what we think is unthinkable today that might happen 5 years from now or 2 years from now. We're talking about the bankruptcy of the largest company in the world and certainly the largest auto manufacturer up till last year. So it's quite a shocking event. The The second thing that's really shocking about it is that this is this crisis that has unfolded is really shaping up to sort of be a perfect storm, certainly in the city of Detroit and most of the auto-based towns. Has also been targeting the remaining union, the powerful union in the United States of Manufacturing, and it's really practically the death knell of the UAW as we've known it. And it's really a culmination of 20 years of debilitating blows against our union, and I think this is sort of the final blow, and it's almost scripted that the UAW will no longer be able to exceed the standards set by non-union factories in the South. And that's actually in language. So it's a very tragic day, and it will bring about many dire consequences for the automobile manufacturing centers in the U.S., the unionized ones, and certainly later on down the line, I think it'll affect the non-union ones as well. I think that going forward, it also is really a moment of great possibility, and the signs that I'm seeing now, the signals that I'm seeing now, is that the opportunity is not being seized, and I think that this is important to discuss because this is an opportune moment for really making some profound and productive and useful changes for our country going forward.
Frank, what will the repercussions, you think, be in many of the towns and cities that you're talking about throughout the Midwest and the South, where car manufacturing is the mainstay of employment? GM has certainly laid off some 100,000 employees in recent decades, and more to come. 1,100 car dealerships are scheduled to be closed. The parts manufacturers, of course, will be affected by this, as will their employees. Do we really have any idea what the extent of the damage will be in terms of the economic repercussions?
Probably not. I think that I think it's being minimized. I think that the consequences will be felt with us for quite some time. We already have well over 25% unemployment in the city of Detroit alone. They're predicting an official unemployment rate in Michigan of going up to 20%. And what this will mean in terms of people losing their homes, people being unemployed, and so on, I think that it'll have far-reaching consequences. And I think that we don't even know the half of it yet, because as these dominoes fall and all the parts suppliers go into probably liquidation bankruptcy, there's going to be just all kinds of blight in what were once vibrant auto towns of substantial working class populations that are going to be devastated. You know, and they're specific. I can tell you specific stories. We have two very active workers retired from Chrysler, or a man and his wife, and their son, who's an electrician in the construction industry, has only worked 6 months out of the last 2 years, and they're now having to support him off of his pension. And in the meantime, he's losing his optical care, his dental care, and stands to lose more in the way of health care. So these losses are having ripple effects on families, and I think it's going to be very, very, very stressful for families, communities, neighborhoods. That's what I see in the immediate future.
Frank, as it was apparent that this latest economic downturn, this severe recession, was going to take such a toll on GM, Chrysler, and to a lesser extent Ford, There was a debate in Congress as the Bush administration was exiting the scene and Obama was coming in about what to do. There were many conservative politicians who said, do nothing, let it die, let it, you know, let it fall where it's going to fall. And then, of course, Obama was an advocate of pouring in some billions of dollars to keep GM, particularly in Chrysler, too, afloat until these accommodations for bankruptcy could be met. Was there an alternative way you think this could have been handled with better prospects for employees and their families?
Well, I want to point out that what was striking to me was how seamless the transition was from the Bush administration to the Obama administration. By that I mean that the senators you're talking about, which were these Republicans in the southern states like Corker and Shelby, they were stipulating various demands that basically the UAW matched the terms of the southern non-union transplants, and they made a lot of noise. There was a lot of fanfare. Bush, at the end, conceded to giving a bridge loan, and then when Obama stepped in, he actually upped the conditions that were originally set out by the Republican senators, and actually demanded greater sacrifices and greater concessions from the UAW than even Shelby and Corker were. So it was really staggering to see how seamless this was and how different Obama's approach had been, was from what was appearing under the previous administration. In response to specifically to your question, this is a time for big thinking, and I think Obama spoke about that in his campaign up leading up to his successful election. The big thinking in this case would have been not the reorganization, not going into the reorganization of a Chrysler, not going into the reorganization of GM as automobile companies, but rather taking a whole new look at a whole transportation industry and developing a new industrial policy for coming up with a redefined transportation industry that would include expedited development of rapid transit, of cleaner mass transit systems. And I think that that opportunity maybe was talked about, but if you look at the details of the proceedings up to date, there really is no view currently of doing that. So all we're ending up doing is salvaging the name of the brand of GM. But in the meantime, we're shuttering 14 plants, 11 to be closed permanently, 3 to be idled, with 21,000 more workers out on the streets.
So you feel Obama has missed an opportunity here in terms of reorganizing the auto industry into something that is more sustainable, both for the employees and for the planet, our environment, and all that.
Yes, I believe that to Obama's credit, he spoke and focused much attention on the issue of climate change, global warming. And it seems that this is really the opportunity that presents itself. We're going to have 11 shuttered plants. What's going to happen with the plants? It seems to me that that now with the government owning the majority stake in General Motors, that it would be a time for Obama to say, we do need to run this industry, and we need to run it in a new direction that will reduce our carbon footprint, aid in resisting the trend toward irreversible tipping points in global warming, at the same time providing employment opportunities in the communities that are being devastated. So it would be a win-win in many ways for him to have really put forward that direction. And I think that what he's done is actually very limited.
We're speaking with Frank Hammer, a 32-year veteran employee of General Motors, former president of United Auto Workers Local 909 in Warren, Michigan. And we're talking, of course, today about General Motors Corporation filing for bankruptcy here. A very historic day. And, Frank, about the issue of sustainability, do you have faith in the executives running General Motors today that they will be able to see this reorganization through, both to eventual profitability, maybe taking some of these employees who've been laid off back, and at the same time moving the industry in a new direction in terms of more fuel-efficient vehicles that are desired by the consumers, and also at the same time reducing the pollution of these vehicles?
That's a multi-part question. I think on the question of profitability, one of the aspects that I think is very disappointing is that General Motors is going to set up more manufacturing centers in places like China or South Korea to export vehicles, completed vehicles, back to the United States for sale here, so that they can use rather cheap labor to make profit for the company by selling imported brands here as a GM, with a GM label. So I think that that might be their view to profitability, but it's not going to do very much for American workers. In regards to the environment, I had the good fortune for about 5 years of working as a union representative on sourcing questions for GM engines and transmissions in Pontiac, Michigan. And during my time there, I noticed that every new project for new engines always started with CAFE standards. They had to meet the governmental CAFE standards, and that's what their starting point was. So I believe by Obama insisting that the CAFE standards I think increased by 5% per year, that companies are going to be dragged into producing more fuel-efficient vehicles. I think that's the force that's going to be behind General Motors making that change. I wish I could say that the General Motors executives would be leading the charge, but I don't think they will. They will be dragged to do it by a force of the U.S. government.
As I understand it, the United Auto Workers, in exchange for concessions on retiree health benefits, are going to get, and many other concessions, are going to get something like a 20% share of General Motors Corporation as it's reconstituted. What kind of influence do you think the UAW will have, can have, on the direction of the new company?
I'm not optimistic about how much influence the UAW will have, and I want to point out that I think there's going to be a 13-person board of the new owners of General Motors, and I think we get one seat out of 13. I think that in regards to the controlling interest is actually not the UAW. It is going to be the UAW VIBA Trust Fund, and that trust fund consists of 11 board members, five of which are UAW and six of which are not. They're independent. That's the trust fund that has at stake in the new reconstituted General Motors, and I don't think that the UAW will have much influence there either. And the UAW has already signaled that it wants to sell these shares because it has to pay for health care out of that 17% ownership. It has to. That's where the sources of funds are going to come to help out paying for retiree health care. And that's very shaky at best.
Frank, I know one of the most important questions that you and other retirees have been dealing with is health care. What role do you think the failure of the United States to have comprehensive health care for all Americans played in the demise of General Motors? And where do you think we need to move now with regard to reforming our health care system in this country?
I think that it's one of the pivotal pivotal issues that helped to bring this crisis about. These Republican senators that you mentioned earlier were very keen on talking about these legacy costs that we have in the big three. The reality is that the Southern non-union plants in total have 1,500 retirees because they have a young workforce. They're not confronted even with the problem of health care, whereas the big three have hundreds of thousands of retirees who served their time and who were entitled to company-provided health care. The UAW was never for the idea of employer-based health care. In the 50s, it argued for national health care. It lost that argument, and now we're reaping the results of company employer-based health care. In 2005, the UAW and GM both recognized the problem that health care costs were causing for the big three and for GM specifically, and the parties mutually agreed to pursue a national health care solution, citing Canada as a possible model. And though they made that agreement on a piece of paper, signed letter, the whole thing, they both walked away from that agreement and never pursued it. I think we'd be much further ahead in the struggle for health care reform in the United States had GM and the UAW done what they said they would do, and that is to lobby and to build coalitions for health care reform. We would be much further ahead than we are now, and we maybe would have saved GM from going into bankruptcy as they have done.
Where do you stand on health care? You want to move to a single-payer health care system?
Well, you know, I live in John Conyers' home district. John Conyers has been advocating for years now a single-payer Medicare for all, everybody in, nobody out, healthcare system. And I've certainly been one to it and believe that it's the only method by which our country can come back on a level playing field with most of the rest of the industrialized world, and at the same time finally address the fact that we have 45 million people in this country with no health care at all. And I think that the what we needed to do and what we need to do is challenge the profit-making healthcare industry and saying, you know, it's time for you to go. We need to address the healthcare issues of our people, and at the same time enable manufacturing industry to compete on a level playing field with other industrialized countries.
Well, on that note, Frank, we've run out of time, unfortunately. I'd love to have you back here to talk about, you know, some months down the line when we have a feeling for where this reorganization at General Motors is headed, your feeling and your fellow workers' feeling about is it a good turn, bad turn? And, of course, the healthcare debate is critical as well, as you just said. So I'd love to have you back here, and I want to wish you and all your fellow employees there that are confronting some real hard times there with what GM and the auto industry in general is going through, solidarity from, I know, many people out in our audience, myself included. And, Frank, would you advise people to check out the United Auto Worker website or other websites that would give people some maybe different perspectives on what GM has gone through?
I would certainly advise coming to the website autoworkerscaravan.org. There's some material there that you'll find useful, and I think the other item that I would like to say goodnight with is to tell you that Detroiters are going to come together in something called the People's Summit. It'll be June 14th to June 17th, and your listeners can check out peoplesummit.org. Everybody's invited to come to Detroit, and we're going to be holding a tent city in downtown Detroit, and to talk about the loss of jobs, the loss of homes, the loss of health care, and finding a way to respond so that people's needs can be met.
All right. Well, that's something that we can look forward to covering, and I certainly hope to invite you back here again to talk about that, the June 14th, the 17th People's Summit in Detroit, and a lot of the other related issues. Again, thanks so much for being here, Frank, and best of luck with all this turmoil.
I thank you very much, and I thank your listeners.
Okay. Take care, Frank.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That was Frank Hammer, 32-year veteran employee of General Motors and past president of UAW Local 909 in Warren, Michigan. The People's Summit is June 14th through the 17th, and autoworkerscaravan.org is a website that Frank recommends there. So that's it for tonight. Thank you all for listening. Go to our website, WPKN.org, make a secure online contribution. Find out more about our programming schedule. Find out ways you can help and volunteer here in our week coming up. We have a fun drive, and we'll be back here at 8 o'clock next Monday evening to talk about that fun drive and ask for your contributions. So get ready, and I hope you can be generous. So thanks for listening. This is WPKN in Bridgeport at 89.5 FM, WPKM in Montauk, New York at 88.7 FM. Looks like we got John Laser and JF coming up next. Clear the studio and make way for them. We'll see you again next week. Thanks for listening, and be generous with the contributions when the fun drive starts this Saturday, an 8-day drive beginning this Saturday, June 6th. Stay tuned.
Good evening. You're listening to WPKN 89.5 FM, Bridgeport, Connecticut. I'm John Laser. I'll be with you here for a couple of an hour or so this evening as I'm getting text messages over here. And this evening, hopefully in about 5 minutes or so, we will be interviewing the artist Beth McKee, who has a great new album out, and we'll be hopefully getting in touch with her. But in the interim, a few songs to play, so let's get started. And like I said, hopefully Beth will be calling in shortly, so we'll kick that interview off shortly.
In that fashion, I have been a good man. I have loved it. I have lost. Ever. In my way, there have been times I have seen the river in the bad times, in the good. I have been down, I have touched the ground, saying prayers and touching wood. Telling you it's all a big mistake.